from the economy to the family system, life is going to be better for men and women if there's equality across the board. And it's you cannot overemphasize that point.
To this episode of the Ravencast. The Ravencast is an online magazine where we talk about mimetic theory and the conflicts and rivalries and the hostility that seems to just be permeating throughout our culture, especially these days. And that is why I am so excited to have with us today on the Ravencast, Aaron Wathen. Aaron, how are you?
Hi, I'm well, Adam. How are you?
Good. Thank you for being here. Aaron has just written this fantastic book called Resist and Persist, Faith and the Fight for Equality. And Aaron, I read the book last week, sent you a list of questions, and there's just been all kinds of craziness happening in the last week. So I don't know if we're going to get to the questions, but we're going to talk about feminism and the fight for equality. And I'm looking forward to having the conversation with you.
Yeah, let's do that.
So Aaron is the senior pastor at St. Andrew Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, in the Kansas City suburbs. So if you're in the Kansas City suburbs, go check out St. Andrew's Christian Church. Aaron, I was so impressed to see this. You are the 2010 recipient of the Fred Craddock Award for Excellence in Preaching. Fred Craddock Award, that's a pretty big deal.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Nicely done there. Aaron writes at the Pathos website under the very popular blog, appropriately entitled Irreverent. Nicely done there, Aaron.
Thanks. See what I did there.
Yeah, right? That's good. I see that. Nicely done. Aaron is the author of multiple books, including More Than Words, 10 Values for the Modern Family, Partners in Prayer, and the book that we will be talking about today called Resist and Persist, Faith and the Fight for Equality. So, Aaron, how did this book come about? Why this book?
Well, I guess the short story is that the publishers actually approached me shortly after the 2016 election and asked me to write what they called The Nasty Woman's Guide to the Resistance.
Oh,
yeah, that's what I said to
you. Nicely done.
My first thought was, fun, I'm so in for that. And then I got to thinking about the title and that might have kind of a short shelf life because Nasty Women was already a past trending topic at that point, and we were looking at a year of writing and production time. So I said, you know, I think there's a way to create the message and the voice that you're looking for, which is a really particular feminist faith-based response to the current political climate, but to shift the title a little bit so it's got some more staying power and so it's going to engage a broader audience and not just be kind of a party line, kind of ideological meltdown situation. So we work to kind of nuance the title a little bit, and that's how we got to Resist and Persist. But I think it is still that faith-based feminist response to what felt like really toxic rhetoric at the time, and still feels like unfolding daily horror of toxic climate towards women and women's bodies and women's place in the world. So that's where we started, and that's what we're still about. If the book really was meant to start a conversation, not to answer every question, but to get people in multiple circles thinking deeply about these issues from a faith perspective and hopefully talking about them in a way that churches have avoided talking about these things because they are so divisive in a lot of frames. So tried to kind of open that up a little bit.
Yeah, you do a great job talking about Christian faith and how it's played into patriarchy. And maybe like one of the first things we should do is just kind of define patriarchy.
Okay. In the most basic terms, I'd say patriarchy is the white masculine worldview that assumes its own privilege is the authoritative and defining element of everything, of every other part of culture, and that everything else in culture gets its value from its relationship to that white masculine perspective.
Yeah. And how has Christianity, when you were talking about Christianity in this book, I was like, maybe we should just get rid of this whole thing. Like, as a pastor, I was like, oh my gosh, this, maybe it's like, it's cooked into the whole thing. And you actually provide a critique of that. Like, you say that it seems like you're saying that Christianity has within it the ability to lead us into a more equal way of being in the world.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And you're not wrong that patriarchy is baked into the culture and the message, but it also holds the key if we're ever willing to dig deeply enough to get to it and to get past the ideological hard right and hard left divides that keep us from getting there. Because Christianity, in essence, is a following of the way of Christ. And the way of Jesus was always the way of reaching the marginalized, seeing people who hadn't been seen before, empowering people who hadn't been empowered before. And that included women. He engaged women at a completely different level than other people around him in that same time, especially women who were poor or in some marginalized ethnic group. And somehow, as the Christian movement gained traction in popular culture and became kind of wrapped up in empire in its early days, then that, again, that tone of patriarchy started to override everything. But if you are really about following the way of Jesus and not about chapter and verse proof texting a few little things here and there, there really is a lot of empowerment in Scripture for women.
One of the stories that you highlighted about Jesus that really reframed this whole thing for me and what we're dealing with today was the story of Jesus and the Canaanite woman. And I brought this up to my progressive-leaning church a couple of weeks ago as one of what I thought one of the most important stories in the New Testament, and they had never heard it before. Could you talk about the importance of this story for you?
Are you talking about the crumbs from the table?
Yes. Yes.
You know, it's one of those where, and I think there are several instances like this where a woman approaches Jesus and, you know, his initial reaction is maybe about what you'd expect it to be. It's kind of, get out of here. I don't have time for this. You're not one of my people. You know, I'm here for this particular community in this particular time. And rather than just kind of slinking away, she pushes back and she says, you know, even dogs get crumbs from the table. And she turns around this kind of ugly slang word that he has used against her. And she flips the script on him, right? Which is what we know Jesus for doing frequently, is flipping the script. So it's almost like she's modeling that here. She flips the script on him and kind of demands to be seen and demands to be heard. And he does a turnaround. And so you see that even Jesus has some space to grow and learn. And then, you know, he, from that point on in the story, he treats her in a much more fully human kind of way. And I think we see that happen frequently. I call those stories the Jesus, where is your mother moment, when he kind of just is an ass for a second. Uh-huh. And then he kind of goes, oh, okay. So you almost wonder if he's got like that mother's voice in his head that so many of us do. Oh, if something happens to like flip that switch where he goes, oh yeah, see, you know, my mom would want me to be nice to this girl. So that's kind of, you see that happen a lot more than you realize. So I think that's a really meaningful story. And then the connection I make in the book is, in social justice work, there's calling in and there's calling out. And there's a time and a place for both, and those are both very important practices. But what we see this woman do is she calls Jesus in. She doesn't call him a sexist asshole. She says, you know, let's try that again, Jesus. I'm gonna make you see me in another way. And that's exactly what she does. And so he's been called into a relationship and into a place where he has another chance at a more gracious response. And that's the work. And that's what we're here for.
It was so, that frame of calling in versus calling out was so kind of new to me. I hadn't ever heard it that way before, but I feel kind of like we're in this cultural moment where everybody is calling out, and it's like, we call this person out, and it happens at the Red Hen. And, you know, Sarah Sanders, there's a part of me that says, yes, you should have, that's exactly what you should have done, because your LGBTQ co-workers didn't feel comfortable. And that's exactly what you should have done. You should have called her out. But there's another sense in which when you do that, especially with the Trump administration, they're so good at being the victims of called out. And so then they call you out in return.
And you're feeding.
Yes. And I don't know what to do about it. Like, I was just having this Facebook conversation with a friend who was like, yeah, I went to the protest at ICE, and it just seemed to like piss them off all the more. And it just emboldened them.
Right.
So what do we do? We don't want to be silent about it.
Right.
But we want to voice something, but how do we find this like third way of doing it?
I think you just keep calling in. You keep extending that space for a more gracious response and assuming the best of that person, even if they're being just really ridiculous in the moment. And I'm saying that like it's something easy. It's not, and I don't do it well always, but I think there are people out there modeling that really well right now. So that's the critical thing, is to find the people that are modeling it well, whether they are folks like you that are engaging in podcast and conversation kind of spaces, or religious leaders, faith leaders, some political leaders, believe it or not. Just find those people that are doing that well and go there. Go where they're going. Talk to the people they're talking to and model it.
Love it.
That's all I got.
Yeah, that's great. We do have some people watching on the live feed, so I just want to encourage anybody watching to feel free to make comments or questions there on the Facebook page, and we will bring you into the conversation. So a lot of people, when they hear feminism and equality, one of the stumbling blocks is that for men, maybe especially, is that they feel that if we work for feminism, it's working against men.
Right. And that's classic male privilege talking, really.
Yeah.
That says what's good for women must be bad for me. Where does that come from? Where do we get that narrative? It's pretty deeply ingrained, but it's also garbage. So that's something that needs to be unwound for this forward.
Yeah, and you do a great job unwinding it in your book, because you make the statement that feminism equality is good for everyone, including men, including boys. And could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. It's, you know, obviously it's multi-layered, and there are a lot of different angles to that. But one of the ways I try to draw out a little bit is that you know, inequality for women is an economic issue, because there's still a deep pay divide between what women make in their lifetime, what men make in their lifetime. And yet there are more and more women in the workforce, women are still making a much lower percentage of the overall what's out there in the economy. So when women have less capital, you wind up with more women in poverty, which creates all sorts of other economic issues that hinder our economic growth. And so working for equality is really working to end poverty. It's these are things you cannot extract from each other. Everything from childcare costs to family leave policies to women being dramatically underrepresented in higher leadership roles in big companies. I mean, you might have the company might be half women, but the chances of the CEO or the CFO being female dramatically lower, the higher up you get. Same in church, really. There are about half of the clergy coming out of seminaries these days are women. But when you get up into larger churches, you know, your percentage of women senior pastors falls way down below 10%. And it's just very problematic in a lot of ways. And from the economy to the family system, life is going to be better for men and women if there's equality across the board. And you cannot overemphasize that point.
Yeah, I remember reading in your book brings up two statements. Churches hire women because they think that they can pay them less than they have to pay a man.
And they do pay them less than they have to pay a man. Yeah, absolutely.
It's awful. And then you talked about like in business, and a lot of people who argue against this will say, oh, but women, they don't want to be in business. They don't want to be leaders of businesses. Right. You've heard this before.
Oh, sure.
And it reminded me of the same argument is made about politics. Mm-hmm. Women don't want to be in politics. But the United States is, you have this stat, and I forget exactly what it's something like 75th. In the world, as far as female leadership, political leadership. I mean, that's crazy.
It is insane. It's insane.
So anyway, you're bringing all of this to light to me, and I'm learning so much. So
good.
So thank you for it. One of the other things that I learned, a new phrase, was internalized misogyny.
Yes.
What is that?
Oh, man. I just learned the phrase, too, when I was when I was working on this book was the first time I came across that language, and it just blew my mind because I could think of so many times in my own life I had seen that acted out, and I could find so many places in culture to point to examples of it. But basically, internalized misogyny is when women have so utterly bought into the lie of patriarchy and the assumption of male power and superiority that they work against their own interests in order to protect that narrative, in order to uphold that system. And a lot of times it's because it's what's comfortable. I mean, buying into what is a lot more comfortable than recognizing the deep brokenness and the pain of how it's affected women's lives for generations and how it continues to harm women. And you just have internalized that message so deeply that you are just as complicit in sustaining it as men are. And I think we saw that play out significantly in the last election cycle, with 50% of white women voted for Trump, who is a known and blatant misogynist. But there was all that narrative of like, well, he knows how to run a business, so like, I'm going to let him make me feel safe and comfortable. Or that's just locker room talk. All men are like that. All men talk like that. Garbage. No, they don't. And if you
Thank
think
you.
That better quality men in your life is, and see, that's another thing that's insulting to men, right? The whole, all men are like that. That's a deeply harmful narrative for men. And so unwinding that assumption is good for men. It's empowering for men to be seen as more than that, like, baser instinct kind of caveman.
I've been to plenty of locker rooms in my childhood and adult life, and the last time I heard language like that was in middle school. I mean, it's why do people give a pass on this? Internalized misogyny is a great way to frame it. It makes a lot of sense. And that's the narrative of patriarchy. And another narrative of patriarchy that it uses against women is to divide women on hot topic issues. And you explain this really well, especially when it comes to the issue of abortion. And we've just had Justice Anthony Kennedy retired. And so now there's all of this anxiety, all of this about who's Trump going to pick next. And it's right. probably going to be somebody who is not good for women. Anyway, your conversation, your discussion about abortion was also really helpful for me, and how patriarchy divides women in these really hot topic issues. Right. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, you know, I was out in my own neighborhood today, and I saw a bus, I mean, a big tour bus size bus parked at the high school in my neighborhood. I don't know if it was just taking a break or if they had some kind of event over there today, but it was for a candidate for governor. And I, excuse me, I've lost the name of the candidate because we've got like 85 people in the pool right now. I mean, not really, but there are so many candidates right now. But as my quick drive by, I caught the words, again, this is the candidate. This is the candidate for governor. It says Christian pastor, pro-life, pro-gun, pro-America. And I said, something about that math just does not quite add up. I think the term pro-life is a complete shade for everything that a word like that should contain. One of the things I talk about in the book is working towards an ethic of life that isn't just focused on birth, but a whole life, a sacredness of life and opportunity and care and nurture and all those things. And what patriarchy has done so effectively is take all that nuance out of the conversation. It's this completely binary thing. You're either pro-life or you're evil feminist baby killer. And there's no space for anything to happen in between. And I think above all, that is a product of not having women in those higher levels of government. Because if we had more women with legislative power, that conversation would be a completely different conversation. But what we have instead is men making decisions about women's bodies, and then they drive this wedge to divide women into far left and far right corners so that women never really get together around their own interests and for their own empowerment. And I think that the most powerful and important work that the women of our generation can do is just call BS on that whole narrative and learn to have a more compassionate, nuanced conversation about life and procreation and the whole maternal experience, and how we want to collectively care for our children as a nation after they're born, not before they're born and not the minute they're born, but for their whole lives. And I think women have the power to do that. But again, you get into that internalized misogyny. We're allowing powerful men to take that power away from us so that we really never get that far in the dialogue.
Your book was a reminder of how far we have to go. Like, it wasn't too long ago when we had a senator or congressman, I can't remember what he was, who was saying that women have a way of shutting that thing down when they
That whole thing down. Oh my gosh. That was just a couple years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
The woman's body has a way of shutting that whole thing down. I'd forgotten about that, man.
Well, you reminded me of it, and it was just a few years ago. And so we're not removed from it.
No, we're not. We're not. And there are people out there running right now for the midterms that have that same mentality or have said equally appalling and ignorant things about rape, about reproductive rights, about any number of things to do with women and women's bodies. But I keep going back to that picture. It was really soon after Trump got elected, and it was a picture of about 20 white men in a room signing a piece of legislation that was going to significantly affect women's health care, not just nationally, but globally speaking. And they were all they all had this just like smarmy, smug, like smile, like they had just done something really terrific for the people that put them in office, half of whom were women. And it was like, here is our gift to you. And not a woman in the room, not a single one making all these decisions about women's bodies. It's just deeply, deeply troubling. And I think also really telling about where we are right now and what we have allowed to take shape for our time.
Yes. We've got a few comments here. Patty Kupchad Hall says, goes back to our conversation on calling in versus calling out. She has a heart by it. I think that
makes sense.
That's good.
If you want to hear more about that, let me refer you to the place where I kind of got the language for that discussion in the book. It was an episode of On Being, and Ruby Sales was the guest. So if you just Google On Being and Ruby Sales, it should come up. And I can post a link in the comments later, too. It is a really terrific interview with Krista Tippett and Ruby Sales, and they have some excellent conversation about that.
I am so glad that you brought that up, because jarred my memory of something that I wanted to ask you. But first, Lori Haley says, Aaron rocks. So nicely done there.
Hi.
Yes, that's awesome. Ruby Sales, your couple paragraphs about her makes this really interesting, intriguing comment about race in America. And I wanted to ask you about women, white women, and the fight for equality and racism that we need to continue to get past first. And then I'll ask the next question.
Okay. I don't know if that's so much a question as a opening up a huge chasm. Is what I found when I was writing this book, because I thought, you know, I need to acknowledge at some point in this book, I need to acknowledge that patriarchy isn't just about women. It's also about people of color. It's about upholding the status and the privilege of not just the male point of view, but the absolute authority of the white male point of view. And I thought, I need to acknowledge that at some point and hold space for that in this conversation. Well, I cracked a couple of books to come up with smart things to say about that. And it sent me down so many rabbit holes that it blew my mind how big a part of the feminist conversation has to be about racism. I had no idea until I started this work. So I really went into the book thinking that was going to be a footnote, and it wound up being a whole chapter and then something I kept, in the forefront the whole way. Because, we were talking earlier about different waves of feminism. This was before we went live, but we were talking, are we on third wave or fourth wave feminism? It really depends on who you ask, but either way, every previous wave of feminism has harmed women of color and has and white women have worked hard for their own privilege at the expense of women of color. And again, this is one of the places where, and I don't want to give us a pass and I don't want to make excuses, but it's the work of patriarchy to divide, right? And what patriarchy has effectively done at certain points in history is tell women, you've got to choose your own interest or some other marginalized group. Like in the women's suffrage movement, or even in the abolitionist movement, I think there were women working to end slavery, but who still would never in life have been able to envision a world where women of color were equal to them in society and economically speaking and in all other sorts of ways. And in the suffrage movement, I think that white women working for the vote ultimately sacrificed their sisters of color to get the vote for white women primarily. And I think that's happened again and again. And it is part of that internalized misogyny narrative too. But once you know that history, you can't unsee it. And so I think that's why intersectionality is so important right now. Because if any of us aren't free, none of us are free. So if we're working for women's equality, we've also got to be working for women of color. And and for racial justice and equality as well. So that's and there are several good footnotes in the book about things to go read in their entirety, because again, I just barely scratched the surface of some of that history. But anything by any work of Ruby Sales that you can find, any word she has uttered or written is gospel. Anything by Bell Hooks, who does not capitalize her own name.
It's so badass.
It really is badass. I mean, that's the life goal, right? If you can't be Madonna or Cher or Beyonce with just the first name, then just say, I don't even need capital letters because I'm that amazing. But yeah, Bell Hooks is the authoritative voice on the black woman of color struggle and how white women have played a role in continuing to do harm there. And she is from Berea, Kentucky, which is about 30, 40 miles away from my little holler where I'm from. So I have a special fondness for her work because she brings this really uniquely Kentucky voice to that conversation about race and misogyny, which I lived in some ways, but realized I did not live at all after I read some of her stuff. So it's definitely worth a read.
But the other thing that really got to me about Ruby's comments on being was she says something like one of the big problems with white men in America is a lack of meaning. And there's a lack of I have always thought white theology in negative terms, but she placed it in something like white people need to come up with a meaningful theology.
Yes.
That is not white theology that, you know, that has been right. handed down to us forever and ever and ever. But we need to come up with a different way of doing theology. That just it freed me up to think about this in a different way, especially yes. as a white male.
And she's talking about identity too. She's talking about just white identity is so flat. It's so based in, just comfort and privilege, and that we don't have the depth of faith or community or anything else that people of color have cultivated through necessity. You know, we haven't had to develop that kind of meaning and that sense of identity because we just have a lot of things handed over. And I felt she was deeply compassionate in what she was saying there. She was locating, her exact words were, where does it hurt? Like in any broken system like this, you look at the element that's the problem, which in this case is the white male. And that's where she gets to the calling in versus calling out thing. Instead of calling out and calling names, she says, where does it hurt? Can we locate the pain that is present in keeping this narrative alive? And for her, that pain is that lack of identity and meaning, like you said. So, and the white church has to work to cultivate some other narrative that gives people that kind of meaning if we want to start taking away some of these other things that are so problematic.
One of the things that's going through my mind right now is I have always wanted to own my own interior racism, right? Like this infects me. And that's one of the pains that I have because it's shameful. But, you know, I've come to the point where I need to admit that this is part of America culture racism. And so it infects me in some way. And that's one way that I am able to own it and deal with it and manage it. But I've also found I used to go in my writings to say, well, if you're white in America, it means that you're racist. And that wasn't always helpful because it's a calling out. It may be true, but it's a calling out, right? Instead of a calling in. And so as you're talking, I'm just like reframing.
Yeah. And again, there is a time and place for calling out. And I think we can have the ability to call ourselves out and maybe even call out people we love if there's a yes and a next step. What are we going to do about that? But you're right. There's not a lot of charity in just that kind of name calling, and people aren't going to hear it well, and there's no room for them to grow or respond from there. So it's about creating space for what's next, for moving beyond.
As you're saying, it's one of the most important things, I think, within the prophetic tradition, the Hebrew prophetic tradition, is that they're always critiquing their own people,
right.
their own nation. Like that's the big critique first. And I don't do this all that well, but maybe like the biggest critique is for me to critique my own progressive people on certain mm-hmm. things, I guess, as opposed to always pointing the finger at right. them, you know,
the others. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. You tell a lot of really great, engaging personal stories in your book. And it's one of the things that makes it a page turner. so it's great. You tell a story at the beginning about your childhood church and at the end about going to a hospital. Can you tell those stories?
Yeah, well, the first one's long, so I'll give the Cliff Notes version. But I grew up in southeastern Kentucky in a small, fairly rural community. It's grown a lot in the last 20 years, but when I was growing up, it was primarily a rural community. But I grew up in a Main Street Disciples of Christ church that was progressive for its context. I mean, I grew up seeing women serve communion and lead in ways that I never thought twice about. And then when I was a teenager and start maybe bringing a friend to church with me every now and then, they're going, your mom's a deacon and you've got women elders. It's just blowing their minds. And I'm like, what? Like, it was just second nature to me. So in that moment, I developed kind of this profound gratitude for having been shielded from the misogyny of my community, you know. But then the sadder end of that story is as I've gotten older and farther from home, that church, like, so, I mean, it's really the story we've heard 1,000 times of other mainline churches in the country that deeply divide over LGBT issues. And they wound up splitting and leaving the denomination. And this just very painful kind of end to the church as I knew it growing up. That was this really kind of brave and beacon, just a brave expression of a gospel of inclusion and equality, and instead, you know, responded to this shifting social scene from a place of fear and scarcity, which, again, you can tell the story 1,000 times, but what happens to your home people, it's really heartbreaking. And so I feel like in a lot of ways that church raised me to be a feminist, even if they're not especially owning that part of their self and identity anymore. So I'll still be grateful for the space it gave me. I mean, clearly because that's the church that raised me in faith and taught me to think deeply and critically about scripture and the world I lived in. And so I can always hold that and have space for that as part of who I am. With still a lot of sadness for what's not there anymore and what they could have been. That's the other thing. It's a church like that in a community like that with no other progressive voice anywhere in the 100-mile radius around them. They could have really been doing some powerful prophetic ministry right now. And instead they look like every other church in town. So it's a disappointment, but we all have those, right?
Yes.
And then the second story you're talking about at the very end was a more recent. In fact, it was the day I wrote that part was the day it happened. I was trying to tie up the book, and I needed, you know, you just need something sometimes. And this happened. And when I got home, I was like, I got it. I've got the end of my book here. So I'd gone to the hospital. It was a weekday afternoon. And I got a call that one of our youth had left school very ill and been rushed to the emergency room. And they suspected it was appendicitis, and it was a, you know, very tense, sounded like an urgent kind of situation. And so, of course, parents were worried and stressed. And I dropped what I was doing and went to the hospital, which luckily it was the one that's a mile from my house and not the one that's downtown in a 45-minute drive and parking ordeal. So I got there, and I don't know, 5 minutes later, but I went quickly, and I was wearing what I'd had on, which was a yoga tank top and a backless shirt, right? And like a Patagonia skirt, which is what I live in the summer. Uh-huh. And this little hospital has, it, you'll appreciate this, it has an abundance of clergy parking. How often do you encounter that in your ministry life? I mean, if they've got like 6 clergy parking spots, and always at least 2 or 3 of them are available. So it's like, score. So I pull in my clergy parking spot, and I'm rushing into this family that I know is freaking out. And this other pastor coming out to get in his car. And first of all, I mean, I don't want to be catty and like judge, but it's 90 degrees that day, and he's wearing a suit. This tells me right away, like, he takes himself way too serious, and his life is just much, you know. So anyway, he's got his Bible, and he's got his jacket, and he's walking past me to his car. And it would not be the first person to look at me like I don't belong in that clergy parking spot. It happens all the time. And if he'd just given me a little bit of a side eye, I would let it go. But he like made a point of stopping in his tracks, circling back, and walking back to like give me a look. You know, and he kind of looked from me to the sign, to me to the sign, and he shook his head and walked away. And I was like, you know, not today, man, not today. Like, I just dropped everything I was doing to come be here with my people. And you don't get to decide based on like how I look or what sort of anatomy I have that I don't get to do this work. And so he was walking away, and I thought he was going to say something to me because he made that point to like stare me down, and he just shook his head and walked away. I kind of backed up and I said, "Do you need to see some ID?" And he was just super startled that I had addressed him. And he was like, "What?" He didn't, like, he couldn't quite process what point I was making. I said, "Do you need to see identification to show you that I'm clergy?" And he just kind of muttered something about that he was just curious, and he got in his car like so fast, and he was gone. And I was like, yeah, I don't have time for this because I got a sick kid in there. So anyway, and the kid's fine, by the way. But I was like, I kind of said that over my shoulder. I was not going to waste a minute of my time, though, like defending my life to this guy who clearly was probably not going to be open to that conversation. And maybe that wasn't a charitable calling in moment. That was definitely a calling out, and was probably me speaking out of the stress of being worried about this family I was trying to get to. But it just, that sort of thing happens all the time. And I think that every time we let it pass and don't engage it, that narrative goes unchallenged. And that man's space is protected, and mine is always questioned and always challenged. And so I challenge back. If I sense a challenge, I'm here for it. I've got ID if you want to see it, or it's none of your business. I'm here. And you can't question me, but I still make the point of naming it and acknowledging it so that you can't just wander away awkwardly, which is what you did.
Yeah, that story was so powerful for me because it's a calling out, but it's not an angry calling out. It's not an informational calling out, right? It's not a hostile, "I'm out to get you." It's a "I belong here, and you're not going to tell me that I don't." Yeah. And that to me, I think is the third way.
And it also says the next woman you see here belongs here too, because there are other women in this community. I know them. I know their names. I know their churches. I see them at the hospital. I see them at clergy gatherings. And, I want him to think twice before he questions one of my colleagues, or just, you know, anybody, any woman anywhere has the right to be where she is. And I think it's time we stop giving a pass to men who question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. My friend Stephanie Pettit says sometimes you have to call out, and that is okay. Absolutely.
Word.
Absolutely. Yes. That's right. Another area where another area where we have to call out and call in all the time is on social media.
Yeah.
Social media has given everyone, including women, a stronger voice, a louder voice, but it has also given, as you say in your book, trolls, for lack of a better word, a stronger voice and a more powerful voice. We'll talk about social media and your experience with it.
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, it's creating space for women's voices that has never been there before. And we're hearing from women who might never have been able to find a platform. And it's creating space for all kinds of great engagement across many different frames of experience and public life. But obviously, you've got like the people who don't really want to engage. They just want to sling some toxic nonsense into the air and vent whatever rage they're probably vaguely concealing in the rest of their everyday lives. And it's just really, if you're a woman out in the world cultivating a voice, you're going to get pushback. But if you're online doing it, there's this sense of carte blanche, I think, that men have to say things online they'd never say to you in person. Or maybe they would. Some of them would. But I think men feel really emboldened from behind that screen to just say really appalling things that, yeah, Jesus, where is your mother? That's all I got. Like, I think they, you know, I've been called a slut and a crazy bitch and also a silly little girl, which these are complete opposite sorts of implications, but they're also both deeply condescending, which just goes to show you how complex misogyny is, because there are lots of ways to be a kind of woman you don't want to be, right? You can be a bitch, you can be a whore, you can be a stupid little girl. These are all just ways to minimize and silence. But for men, there's only so many bad things we can call you, and most of them boil down to calling you a woman or suggesting in some way that you have feminine qualities that are obviously negative, because who would want to be a woman when you could be a man? So, yeah, it's fun out there. It's fun out there. And I have this lovely little blacklist button on my blog that I can shut people down, and they won't come back and they can't comment anymore. But there's 10 more, you know, for everyone you get rid of, there's 10 more that show up. But luckily, I'm not that famous. I mean, I don't have the kind of volume of traffic where I'm fending this stuff off every day. Most of my readers are regulars. They're people I know or have connected with in some circle somewhere, or they're friends of friends, or they're like-minded colleagues and activists and, you know, people out there doing the work of social justice. That's where I pick up most of my traction. So unless I have the really occasional viral post or tweet, I don't get a lot of interaction outside of those circles. So that's the good news. But women who have much wider nets and platforms deal with this every single day. And all I know is you'd have to hire a full-time media manager to fend it off if you were doing this on a bigger scale.
Stephanie has a few more comments that I want to bring in, because they lead to the next question that I want to ask. Let's see. Stephanie says, it is so important for our girls to see women who are not afraid to assert their right to be.
Yeah. Amen.
Yes. Amen. And social media has given everyone a stronger voice, including trolls. Like you said, it really can be a safer place for women to assert our value without fear of physical violence, though. We can fight misogyny and men can support us in relative safety. And she says, loving this guest, by the way. So,
oh, thank you. Thank you.
Stephanie is leading me directly into where I want to go next. Men can support us in relative safety. It's important for women, for girls to see women who are not afraid to assert their right to be. One of the really helpful things about your book that I found was the role of men. I think this gets back to Ruby's comment. Male theology, understanding what it means to be a man. I was asked a couple years ago, what does it mean for you to be a man? I have no idea what it means to be a man, right? This is what I grew up with. It's like, whatever, just be who you are. What is manhood? What is womanhood? You talk about biblical womanhood in the book a little bit. What role, as Stephanie is saying, what role do men have in supporting women in this?
Well, I think first and foremost is being secure enough in your masculinity, whatever that means to you, because it's something different to everybody. And owning that is thing one. So first of all, own there's no one way to be a man, but also being secure enough in whatever masculinity means to you to know that working for women's equality doesn't do anything to diminish your own rights. It sacrifices some of your privilege, but that's not a bad thing, and that's not going to hurt you. You know, it's being able to have a little bit of humility and say that there are times and places that maybe the world has heard enough of voices like mine, and I'm going to step aside and let a woman talk right now, even if maybe she's going to say the exact same thing I would say in this meeting or this sermon or this election or whatever it is. She might say all the same things I would say, but maybe the world needs to hear it from her right now instead of me. Those are starts. I'll tell you another one is just reading this book or reading any book by a woman. I heard these statistics lately about, it's maddening, but I know it's true, how women read books, women who read anyway, people who read a lot, women read books by male and female authors in pretty equal measure. Men read books almost entirely by men. Why do you think that is? I mean, and that's not an entirely rhetorical question, but why
do you think? No, it's not rhetorical at all. If we were to randomly pick 10 books from my bookshelves back there, they would be men.
Yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely.
So I think naming that and saying, you know what, I'm going to make an effort to read books by women and just maybe hear what women's experience is like in relation to the world I live in, that goes a really long way.
I'm glad that you said that. It gets back to calling out progressive men. Yeah. I'll include myself in there. But I read books by progressive men, and in the back on their references, it's just men, male written books all the way through. So thank
you. I've had friends in the process of writing books call me and say, can you write a thing for my back cover? Because I just realized I have no women. And I was like, okay, I can do that any day. I'll put that out there. I will write a blurb for your book if you care enough. If you care enough about having a woman's name in print somewhere on your work. I don't care what you're writing about. I'll read it, and I'm here for it. So it's good.
Stephanie says, yes, girl, let's do that. I like it. That's awesome. We got through my list of questions.
Cool.
That was awesome.
Well, this was fun.
I had a great time. You continue to blow my mind. And thank you. Oh, Stephanie, the book is called Resist and Persist, Faith and the Fight for Equality. And Erin also blogs on the Pathos blog, Irreverent. So you can read her fantastic articles over there. Erin, if people want to keep up with you, how can they do that?
Well, follow the blog is a good way. If you're here in the Kansas City metro, we'd love to see you at St. Andrew Christian Church. Come for worship sometime or just come see me. And those are probably the best ways to find me. And you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Irreverent, IRREV. Erin, Erin. So I'm around.
Brilliant. Yep. I love it. Well, Erin, thank you so much. I've had a fantastic time talking with you about this especially important current event that we're going through. And thank you for being here today.
Well, thanks, Adam.
Everybody else, you can keep up to date with the Raven cast by liking the Raven Foundation Facebook page. And you can keep up with all of our Raven cast videos at the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org. Until next time, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.